From our microphones in downtown Washington, D.C., this is D.C. Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. We have an extraordinarily interesting show today. What works in parole and probation? What works in terms of reentry? We have Bill Burrell, and I'm excited to have Bill on the show. I think he has one of the stellar backgrounds in terms of both from the practitioner experience and academic experience. But first, before getting into the show, I want to thank you. We're up to 135,000 requests a month. Beyond those landing pages, you're looking at an additional 50,000 pages beyond that, and that's a record for us. If you want to get back in touch with us, you can follow me on Twitter at Twitter/LenSipes, S-I-P-E-S, or the email address is Leonard, L-E-O-N-A-R-D, .Sipes, S-I-P-E-S, at C-S-O-S-A.gov. We've had some listener inquiries suggesting that I summarize these programs at the beginning. These programs really are fairly spontaneous. There's a lot of spontaneity. We really don't do a lot of pre-planning. So the point is that what we're going to try to do is to respect your request and to summarize the programs at the end in terms of what the salient points of the discussion were. And for that, or beyond that, what I'm going to do is to read a little bit about Bill Burrell. From 2003 to 2007, he was a member of the faculty in the Department of Criminal Justice at Temple University in Philadelphia. Prior to joining the Temple faculty, Bill served for 19 years as Chief of Adult Probation Services for the New Jersey State Court System. He was responsible for the oversight and monitoring of probation services for the 21 local probation divisions. Bill's chairman of the Editorial Committee for Perspectives of the Journal of the American Probation and Parole Association. He also serves as member of APPA's Board of Directors, and Bill currently serves as member of the Editorial Board of Community Corrections Report. And to Bill Burrell, welcome to D.C. Public Safety.
Thank you, Len.
Bill, one of the conversations we are having on another radio show with Neil Goodlow, who is now with North Point Consulting, but for many years he was a chief probation officer in the state of Virginia, was sort of a sense of this gap, if you will, if there is a gap between the academic community, which is basically leading the changes in reentry and what parole and probation should be doing, the academic or the consulting organizations or the think tanks, and the practitioners are trying to pick up on this and implement this, and sometimes there's a bit of a gap. You've been both chief administrator officer for a parole and probation agency, and you've taught and you write. So is there a gap between the practitioner community and the academic community?
Yes, unfortunately, Len, I think there is quite a gap, and I think it can be attributed in large measure to the different perspectives and goals of the two fields. The academics and researchers conduct the research and publish that research and get rewarded for those publications and those reports, and are not rewarded in that sense for work with practitioners. On the other hand, practitioners have a very urgent set of priorities to get the work done on a daily basis. They may not have the time to read the research. The research may not be readily accessible, published in academic journals, and many times it's written in a style that is not easily accessible to the lay reader or to the practitioner. So we have two groups with different sets of priorities and interests, and their interests do overlap, but that overlap is not sufficient to get the two groups together in a way that enables them to communicate on a effective basis.
I think that is a perfect segue into the second question, because I talk to an awful lot of people, principally from the practitioner community around the country, and their sense of what works or evidence-based issues, and this is the second show in a series of shows that we're going to be doing on evidence-based, and I hope to have you back at the microphones real soon if we don't get everything in today. But this whole concept of you know, beyond drug treatment, and the National Institute of Drug Abuse sets a very specific, creates a very specific list of do's and don'ts, priorities. If you're going to do drug treatment, here's the state of the art in terms of what it is that you should be doing. It's backed up by research. It's backed up by recidivism reports, or how long the person stays addicted, or how long, whether the person returns to addiction or goes throughout their lives without being addicted. That seems to be be almost an open and shut case, but practically everything else in parole and probation, practically everything else in reentry, even though we have a ton of good evidence, there's nothing nearly as specific as the National Institute of Drug Abuse in terms of their guidelines as to what we should be doing in the field. Now, am I correct, or are these people correct, or is that an overgeneralization?
Well, I think it's a fairly accurate portrayal, and that can be attributed, I think, to the fact that NIDA, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, has been around for a long time, is very well funded, and has a long history of not only conducting research, but taking that research and translating it into very useful, practical documents and training for practitioners. So that is a well-oiled machine, if you will, for taking the research and getting it into the hands of practitioners. Unfortunately, in the field of probation, parole, community corrections, we don't have an organization like NIDA. There is the National Institute of Corrections, but in contrast, it's much smaller than NIDA and doesn't have the mission to conduct research or fund research to the level that NIDA does. So we're kind of behind the eight ball in terms of having that resource available to probation and parole practitioners to make that connection between the research and the practitioner, to provide the documents, to provide the training, to provide the assistance that practitioners need to understand and implement cutting-edge research.
One of the sources that I constantly use to when I'm talking with reporters to try to get them to understand that this is something that we, in general, a society, community corrections, parole and probation, people in general, want to get behind to talk about or prove, if you will, the efficacy of this whole concept of reentry, the whole concept of doing something different regarding parole and probation is, and I always get their name wrong, Washington State Public Policy Institute, or the Washington State Institute for Public Policy. I can never remember which. But they have very specific, very readable meta-analysis or literature reviews, as I think we used to call them years ago, providing very specific formulas for what works, to what degree these programs lower recidivism, and what is the cost return to the entity who is investing the money to do reentry or to do new things in terms of parole and probation. And reporters inevitably will say, well, Leonard, that's fine that the state of Washington is doing this, but where's the definitive document from the Department of Justice? So. You know, why do we have a state organization leading us in terms of the results of the research?
Well, I think the Institute is a fairly unique organization chartered by the Washington State Legislature to provide the legislature with independent objective assessments of research to help guide their policymaking. Now, the beauty of the work that the Washington State Institute for Public Policy does is that it's not limited just to Washington activities. They cast a very wide net when they do their research. So folks around the country are able to draw on that. It's a resource that's publicly funded and available. You're right, their material is very well written, very accessible, very clear. So the fact that it comes out of that one state shouldn't limit our use of it in any sense. We have in many states you have a reluctance to rely on program evaluations and research from other states because of what I call the not invented here syndrome. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, our state is unique and we need our own research. And unfortunately, I think that position is misguided. While there are variations among the states in terms of the offender populations and what particular drug might be abused in one state versus another, offenders are very similar from state to state. So if you can find a program that has worked and has been documented to be effective, there's usually not a great deal of tinkering that needs to go on with the program itself to translate it from one jurisdiction to another.
Now, I agree, and then I'm going to take a step away from the negative and go over to the positive. I think most of us, and I think you're in an opportunity, or you have the opportunity, or you've certainly have the history of leading this whole concept. I think a lot of us believe that there is, quote unquote, a better way of doing things, that the cumulative research from a wide variety of organizations, from a wide variety of entities, including other states' research, including federal research, seems to indicate that if we provide lower caseloads in terms of parole and probation agencies, if we provide for social needs of the offenders, and my quick discussion about that is mental health. Who would deny an individual coming out of the prison system mental health treatment? I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're on, mental health treatment, I think everybody would pretty much support that, because I think everybody would pretty much understand that if the person doesn't receive mental health assistance, and in all probability, he's going to come back into the criminal justice system once again. There seems to be a growing consensus that programs plus enhanced supervision measures do reduce recidivism, do create a scenario that you have fewer victims of crime, do save all of us, all taxpayers, money, and that this is in combination probably the best thing to do in terms of public safety. Now, both of us, I think, would agree with what I just said.
Yes, well, I think the part of the challenge when you're talking about reform of any organization, whether it's probation and parole, you get into the question of the philosophy of the organization and what their mission is and what they're designed to accomplish, and this is where we get into the soft on crime type of arguments that treating offenders, putting them in programs, is soft on crime. And I think you have to look at the ultimate outcome of what you're trying to produce. You're putting people, whether it's an addicted offender or a person with mental health problems, getting them into a treatment program, providing services to them, is designed to stabilize the behavior and prevent future crime. So the ultimate outcome, what we're looking for, as you mentioned, is fewer victims, increased public safety, lowered recidivism. And that can translate directly into reduced costs of all types for taxpayers at all levels, whether it's municipal, county, state, or federal government.
And my contention is that it still goes hand in hand in terms of, I guess, the harder side of community supervision. We, as well as many parole and probation agencies throughout the country, remain a law enforcement agency with a law enforcement role. So we have no problems in terms of putting people back in prison. We have no problems with using global positioning systems or satellite tracking. We have no problems with really insisting that the offender do the right thing and have a lot of contact with that offender, probably within my agency, the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency, maybe more contact than just about any place else in the country. So we're not against, and we work with law enforcement on a day-to-day basis. We share a ton of information as to who's doing what. But I think both can reasonably coexist at the same time. We were serving warrants one time, and I use this example all the time. We were serving warrants in the District of Columbia, and a woman came out and said, what are you doing? And we said, we're serving warrants. And she said, what kind of warrants? And these are warrants basically for committing new crimes or people who just refuse to go to drug treatment or refuse to participate in court-ordered programs. And she said, that's fine. Take the bad guys. Take the people who are a danger to society, but help the ones who aren't. And I thought that provided a lot of clarity to this whole discussion of being hard on crime or soft on crime. I think both can easily coexist with each other, correct?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, if you look at some of the most interesting research that I'm really disappointed hasn't gotten into the hands of more probation and parole professionals around the world, for that matter, is some work that Jennifer Scheme of the University of California at Irvine has been spearheading recently, and that's looking at the role of the probation and parole officer vis-a-vis dealing with offenders under supervision. And what her research shows clearly is that the most effective role for a probation parole officer is this, what they call the dual role of helping offenders deal with their problems and challenges and getting their lives in order, at the same time as holding them accountable for compliance with the court order, for staying arrest-free, and doing the more enforcement, surveillance, monitoring types of activities. And there's some real interesting research goes back to Canada back in the 80s, and they looked at this question of activities of probation parole officers, and they found the most effective supervision strategy was to have that balance of helping and monitoring and accountability. And if either one of them dropped out of the mix, the effectiveness rates went down. In other words, we had more failures. So, you know, the idea that you have to be one or the other, that's really a false argument. The most effective approach for probation and parole is to have that balanced, integrated approach where you're enforcing the court or parole board order, you're holding the offenders accountable for their behavior vis-a-vis the conditions of supervision, but at the same time, you're working on helping them get the problems under control, learning new skills to survive in the community, because if you look at offenders generally, you know, they've grown up, I mean, chronologically they may be adults, but developmentally, they're locked somewhere in their adolescence. They haven't learned the full set of skills, pro-social skills, that you and I learned growing up that enable us to survive in society effectively in a pro-social way. So just telling offenders to do these things and watching them closely to make sure that they follow those conditions is not a wise strategy, because they just don't have the capabilities that they need. They don't know how to manage themselves and their life activities in a way that allows them to live successfully in the community. So if we're serious about helping them get through supervision without committing new crimes, we have to pay attention to, we have to address, we have to intervene on these factors, these skill deficits that they have, and teach them these new skills, let them practice the skills, reward them when they do well, and then they begin to change the way they look at and think about their life, their community, their family, their neighbors, and so on. So the bottom line for any probation parole officer is to find a way to blend these two sets of skills, the enforcement and monitoring and the helping and intervention skills.
We're quickly halfway through the program, which is why I want to bring back to the Bill back to the microphone several times to continue this discussion. Bill Burrell, he is from the Lawrenceville, New Jersey area. Bill, is it okay that I give out your email address?
Sure.
Okay, it's William, WILLIAM.Burrell, BURRELL, at Comcast.net, at Comcast.net, and we'll say that one more time at the end of the program. And again, Bill has a wonderful combination of both real-life experience, 21 years, do I have that correctly? Let's see, 19 years as Chief of Adult Probation Services for the state of New Jersey, but also at the same time with the Editorial Committee for Perspectives Magazine of the American Probation and Parole Association, serves as a member of APPA's Board of Directors, editorial board of Community Corrections Report, and a faculty member at Temple University. Let's go back to that for a second, Bill. Okay, so everything we're saying between you and I, and between the people that I talk to, there is this wider consensus, yet the research seems to indicate that both from the correctional side, the prison side, the jail side, and the community supervision side, the great majority of offenders caught up in the criminal justice system don't get the services they need. Small numbers may get substance abuse treatment, small numbers may get mental health assistance, small numbers may get employment readiness training, but rarely does anybody get the entire package that everybody agrees is necessary for success. Why is that?
Well, again, this is a complicated question, but I think it comes down to two or three points that are critical. First, the research is well ahead of policy in most states and jurisdictions. In other words, so the research says if you deal with these problems, which in the research they call criminogenic problems, or the things that drive offenders to crime, if you address those and deal with them, you'll have greater success. The policy in many, if not most of the jurisdictions, is lagging behind that research knowledge. And as a result, we still have lots of people in prison and very little money invested in programs in prison. So whether it's basic academic education, vocational readiness, drug and alcohol treatment, mental health services, whatever. There's not nearly enough going on in prisons, not to mention in community corrections, to address these problems that offenders have. So there needs to be a shift, if you will, in terms of the philosophy that says we have these folks locked up. We know they're going to come back out into the community. 95% or better of all offenders who are locked up come back out to the community at some point in time. And actually, the average sentence to prison is only a few years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a long period of time until they come back out again. So we need to think about this strategically. A lot of the people in the reentry field say that, you know, we need to start thinking about reentry the first day the person arrives in prison, and I assess their problems and deficits and develop a plan to mediate those problems and deficits and get them ready to return to the community, because we know that's going to happen.
But the larger question, Bill, becomes, okay, we agree. The people who I talk to would line up and say, Bill, we all agree with you, but why is it that way? I mean, there's a certain point where state governments, there's a certain point where federal governments create their own priorities. And they say, this is a priority to us, thereby we're going to fund this and we're going to measure this. And at the state level, that doesn't seem to be happening. Now, with the Second Chance Act and President Barack Obama's strong support for reentry, there may be hundreds of millions of dollars that weren't there before to assist states in terms of doing this. So there may be massive, well, I'm not quite sure it's massive, there may be substantial funding coming from the federal level to help states and localities and nonprofit organizations implement reentry strategies. But at the state level, that commitment just doesn't seem to be there.
That's right. And I think what you're seeing is, again, that lag, if you will, of state policy behind what the research is telling us. And some of that lag is structural. As it takes a while for the state systems to absorb the research. It's kind of like, you know, the old saying about trying to turn an aircraft carrier. You know, it takes a lot of room to do that.
Sure.
So it takes a lot of time for people to absorb and then be able to implement these new programs. So some of that lag is structural. And I think some of it, the lag also is political. There are still a lot of folks in this country who believe that the way you deal with crime is to lock people up. And locking them up is good. Locking up for a longer period of time is even better. But that does tend to be a bit of an ostrich philosophy, you know, putting your head in the sand. As long as they're locked up, they're not committing any crimes. Well, that's true. But as I said before, they're coming back out again.
Mm-hmm.
And if all they do is spend time incarcerated, idle, not working, not dealing with their problems and deficits and skills and so on, lifting weights and watching cable television and trying to find ways to get over on other inmates and staff, they're not getting better. They're not getting prepared to resume life in the community. In fact, they're probably losing opportunities and losing time while they're locked up. So there needs to be a real frank discussion at the political level, at the policy level, about what makes sense for us in terms of how we deal with these offenders. We know we have them. We know they're coming back out again. We can have them sit idly by in a prison, which is much easier for an offender to do that, sit idly by and watch television, lift weights and whatever, than to go to programs, learn new skills, learn how to read if they don't know how, and many of them don't, deal with the tough issues of addiction, of violence, and so on. So I think if you offered an offender the chance to just do 3 years in state prison, flat time, no programming, versus 3 years of hard work on problems, they would probably take that. Well, I'll sit, you know.
I would agree with you.
And you know, we can't allow that to happen. This is an opportunity. They are a captive audience, so to speak, no pun intended. And if we're serious about reducing crime in our neighborhoods and making our citizens safer, we've got to deal with the complex set of issues that and problems that offenders have that drive their criminal behavior. Because locking them up and not doing it is a crazy strategy. We know from a lot of the research coming out of the federal government that offenders coming out of prison, 2/3 of them get back into prison within 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a good record.
No, it's not a very, it's not a good record at all. But then again, there are other people that would say that's proof that the problem is so difficult to deal with that you know, we're just not going to have the success we're looking for.
Well, no, and that's just dead wrong, because we have locked people up, but we haven't done in any sort of systematic way on a meaningful scale the kind of treatment and intervention that we know from the research works. It's a significant investment of resources, and no doubt about it, but it can be done, and it can have an impact on their behavior once they come out of prison, or for those that are on probation while they're in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So for those who say that it hasn't worked, they don't know what they're talking about. They really haven't tried it.
We are saying, both on the community supervision side and in the incarceration side, that incarceration is not the issue, or it's not an issue that we within reentry and parole and probation are willing to pick up on. That incarceration is not the issue. That holding them accountable through tough supervision techniques is not the issue. Beyond that, I mean, granted, so we have tough supervision techniques, probably some of the toughest in the country in my agency. We're not arguing incarceration. The District of Columbia has an 85% of sentence served provision. But what we are saying is that mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, employment readiness, these are three, or job training, that these are three key variables that have to, and others that must be addressed within the prison setting and must continue to be addressed in terms of the community correction setting. So it doesn't seem, in terms of the people that I talk to, it doesn't seem to be a mystery. They feel that there is a consensus in terms of what it is we need to do. Getting state government to fund it is the hard part.
And that's true, but there are some examples of a couple of courageous states have been working with the Council of State Governments on something called Justice Reinvestment. And basically what this involves is looking at your sentencing and correctional policies and making changes and then taking some of the money that is saved as a result of that and reinvesting that back into other parts of the system, for example, probation and parole, to strengthen the supervision in the community. It takes some courage, but we're finding now with the fiscal crisis that the country finds itself in, all of a sudden politicians and policymakers are a little bit more willing to talk about other approaches to dealing with sentencing and corrections.
Because it saves the money.
Right, exactly. They're realizing that the lock them up and throw away the key philosophy that is so popular among lots of politicians is something we literally cannot afford anymore.
Right. And again, it's not an issue of incarceration versus non-incarceration. It's an issue of can we afford it?
That's correct. That's correct. And, you know, the problem of jail and prison crowding is complicated, but it's certainly not rocket science. I mean, we know it's a question of how many people go in and how long they stay. So if you can do things like reducing the length of stay of an offender, of course, there are folks that are dangerous and do need to be incarcerated. But when we get to sentences in, you know, that are measured in decades, to the point where prisoners are literally turning, growing old in prison into their 50s and 60s and 70s, at that point, they've pretty much aged out of crime. They're starting to cost the state a lot of money for health care, and it makes sense to let them out of prison on parole, under supervision, and just through those kinds of, what in many places are known as medical paroles, you can reduce population and make more room within the institution, relieve some of the pressure on prison population through something as simple and humane as a medical parole.
You know, Bill, we're just about out of time in terms of this first program. I hope to do a series of programs with you because I really do think that this issue needs to be reexamined. What I hear from you today is that the research does. It may not be easy. It may not be simple. It may not be summarized in one particular place. But there's enough research to really convince both the state and federal government that reentry and a different way of conducting ourselves in terms of parole and probation or correctional policy, that there is enough evidence there to lead us in a different direction, and that different direction probably will, and there's evidence that it does, reduce crime, reduce the cost to taxpayers, reduce the cost to state and federal government, and provide services to people who desperately need them. It seems at the moment to be a win-win-win situation for everybody. Is that, does that summarize what the what we said?
Yes, I think so. I think there's no question that we know it works. The big challenge is doing it. And that is something that I've been spending a lot of time with over the last few years, is helping folks implement evidence-based practices. These are not self-executing programs. They're not a turnkey type of operation. They take time, they take energy, they take resources, they take leadership to implement, but they can be done.
At the next show, Bill, what I want to really focus on are those states and jurisdictions that seem to be an extraordinarily good job of trying new avenues, because those states do exist, those programs do exist, that they really are plowing new ground.
That's correct. That's
okay. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We've been talking to William Burrell, longtime administrator for parole and probation systems or community supervision systems for the state of New Jersey court system, and former member of the faculty of Temple University, chairman of the editorial committee for Perspectives, and serves as a member of the editorial board for Community Corrections Report, as well as on the board of the American Probation and Parole Association. This is DC Public Safety. We really do appreciate your calls and your emails, and we want you all to have a very pleasant day.